Real quiet in here. Ah. Professor's going to sit down for just a minute here. Folks, listen, I'm going to wrap this up. I meant to do it before the break, so just to put a ribbon on it, the question before the house temporarily is, what is God's primary strategy biblically? And I think it is his covenant relationship with Israel. He's going to put himself on display. And the standard answer is that human history is only and always about God redeeming mankind or redeeming the elect. And I ask here, number three, why is this distinction worth thinking about? That is, I think a more biblical answer is that God's primary strategy is his relationship with Israel. And number one, it is much more theocentric rather than anthropocentric. What I mean by that, is there not something rather distastefully man-centered about human history is all about God getting us saved? Honestly, I mean, there's nobody who appreciates the doctrine of salvation, what God's done, any more than I do, but I just think to make that the sum total of what he's doing. But then, secondly, the narrative, and this is what I tried to say before the break, of all this fits together effortlessly as a coherent, consistent. I was talking to a dear brother, and he said that in so many cases, in order to listen, the fundamental theological error in this regard is what's called replacement theology. Now, I think most of you know what replacement theology is. I regard it as bottomlessly odious. I'll just tell you. It just really disturbs me. But it's the idea that by reason of Israel's hardness, God having made explicit promises to Israel, took those promises away and gave them to what is called the church. Now, they don't like to hear it said that baldly. They like to, you know, give it a different title and all that. But it's exactly what it is. And that's what I have here. Replacement theology is that God forsakes his covenant with Israel and transfers his blessing to the church. And once you do that, I mean, once you embrace that theology, and I like to say, and I heard a guy say this one time in a different context, but I use it again and again, a scientist does not go into a laboratory to look at a microscope through a bug, right? Looks at a bug through a microscope. You shouldn't look at the Bible through your theology. You don't decide your theology and then wax nose the Bible to make it work. And that's what you have to do. All the promises in the Old Testament made to Israel, God really meant the church. He didn't say the church. I got myself in a rather extended debate one time at a church in L.A. with a young man. He's a dear friend. I mean, he was a student at the college and so on, but he was a thoroughgoing replacement theologian. And he finally got frustrated, and he said, Bookman, the reason that in the Old Testament, when God said Israel, people thought he meant Israel was because of their immaturity. And it took the maturity of the New Testament to teach us that he really meant the church. And I said, no, Jason. The reason the people in the Old Testament thought God meant Israel is because God said Israel. I mean, there's no getting around. That's deception. So that mentality that, and same thing with covenant theology. Covenant theology insists that you understand all that God's doing in terms of these three covenants which aren't in the Bible, and the primary one is the covenant of redemption, so everything is about redemption. Christocentric hermeneutics, which is so much the rage today, and it's so demeaning. What was I going to say? I had a thought. Well, at any rate, the Bible can be allowed to say what it's saying, which is, to me, well, that's the way it ought to be. So I like to say that how odd of God to choose the Jews. Are you familiar with that? It's a little, there are different ones who are credited with that and so on, and there are all sorts of replies that you can go online and look that up. It's kind of fun. But it was said in some contempt, how odd of God to choose the Jews. But it becomes how good of God to choose the Jews, because God is putting himself on display and using that terribly, terribly. And built into the covenant theology, replacement theology, all of those, I think, horribly aberrant and Bible-dishonoring sets of ideas, is the idea that it was by reason of Israel's hardness. They were so hard. And so God evidently found a people who were much more receptive. That'd be us, I guess, right? The fact of the matter is, the hardness of Israel is absolutely central to the effectiveness of God's determination to put himself on display. It's only when you come to grips with the reality of, and it's all over the pages of Scripture, but that's God's way to impress us with his covenant-keeping character. There's a very important Old Testament word, chesed, and it's variously translated love. What other translations? Steadfast love, something like that. But it bleeds covenant. It's love in terms of a covenant. And I think the point is, as I say, that what God is doing is putting himself on display, his character, his love, his dependability, by reason of the his covenant with Israel. All right, now, for something completely different. I don't know if you can handle that. But no, it's not completely different. That was part of my introduction. But I really do want us to think about, and it just seemed to me that maybe this will work, progressive revelation. And what I'd like to do, and I have a bit of a PowerPoint here, but you have these notes. And let me just confess, a lot of this will be old hat to a lot of you. Because I always do this when we go to Israel. This is my first, I try and find a way to give this lecture because I'm trying to overview what God's doing in the Old Testament. And I think I may have done it in these sacred precincts before. But I'll go through it rather quickly. I don't know if you believe that or not, but now, I call, here's what I want to do. I want to, first of all, kind of drill down a little bit and allow the Old Testament to speak for itself and to ask ourselves, how is God's strategy, what he's doing in terms of putting himself on, his purpose is always the same, to put himself on display to the entire world and to do it in such a way as to draw that unbelieving world to himself through the ministry of the Spirit. But how is God doing that in the Old Testament? And then how is, because, you know, I mentioned that I think it's a healthy thing to think of God's dealings in human history in terms of this stair step, but see, I'm going to fight with this miserable thing. I can do it in between. Here's what I like to say. If this is progressive revelation, get out of here, go away. This is, I'm not even seeing that. Huh? Yeah, you got to end the slideshow. All right, I'm not going to, it's not worth it, my little grammar. What I did is I drew a stair step like this and then whoop, like that. Because what God does listen, from the Old Testament to the New Testament is a mother may I giant step in progressive revelation. This is stunning. And I want to survey that. So first what we're going to do is try and get our arms around what is distinctive. And when I say distinctive, I mean different than what it is today. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons I think that the Old Testament is a bit of a challenge to a lot of folks, because it is such a culture shock, not only in terms of the culture and so on, but in terms of what God is doing. And there is the tendency, and sometimes this tendency is actually codified into a really ill-begotten theological construct, that what God's doing in the Old Testament is pretty much the same as what he's doing today. So in the Old Testament, that's just Israel, it's just the church in the Old Testament, and the church is just Israel in the New Testament. That, by the way, is replacement theology. Want to know how bad a set that ideas that is? Where would you go in the New Testament to come away with the idea that you ought to have a priest in your church? You wouldn't find that. Where'd that come from, folks? I mean, it's explicit. Israel had priests. We're New Testament Israel, so we ought to have. Where would you get up the idea of an altar? Most liturgical churches have an altar. What about a sacrifice? That's what the Mass is. All of that is a direct consequence of the proposition that we've just replaced Israel. And it's all just one. By the way, if you believe that human history is only about getting people saved, the elect saved, why would you need a kingdom? Amillennialism, I being no, nega is in atheist, and so amillennialism teaches that there is no. John McCarthy used to say, I heard him say one time, that amillennials don't have prophecy conferences. They don't believe in an end-time drama. Just going to go along until God's going to blow a big cosmic whistle and the saved are going to go to heaven and the lost are going to go to hell and we get it on in heaven someplace out there where we float about. And of course, the consequence of that is that there is never a time, this is where I started, in human history where God's majesty is on display. So there is not a season of genuine glorification. Human history has no doxological teleology, no doxological purpose or end. It's just we're going to get people saved. And therefore, what happens is, of course, we always think, what God was really after was the Gentiles. So now, human history comes, Jesus dies, now the gospel goes to all the world, the Gentiles get saved, the Gentile elect, now we go to heaven, that's enough. It's not enough. Well, how did I get off on that? I know, I was saying, but this idea that it's just pretty much God doing the Old Testament same thing as he's doing, it's not true. Now, it is true with regard to his purpose, and that is to glorify himself and to put himself on display to the world. But the way he does it in the Old Testament is absolutely dramatic. So I'm going to give you a little Bible geography here. And again, you may hear this again. If we ever get to Israel together. Oops, did I just yell at you? So I call it the nation of Israel and the purposes of God. You can almost see that. Now you can't see that at all, but it says, seven concepts. I think this is pretty much on your sheet, by the way. I'll have some in the pages, the notes there. I'll have some, on page 3, and I'll have some pictures and so on. But I call it seven concepts, basic to an understanding of what God intended to accomplish for and through Israel in the Old Testament. So I'm going to say again, folks, what's at stake, and what I want you to think about rather carefully, and all of this under the heading of, the progress of Revelation. So God is putting himself on display in very distinctive ways in the course of human history, and the Old Testament was very different. So I have seven concepts, and we'll see how far we get. Number one, and I already talked about this, so I'll be quick, but the intent and importance of Israel's influence, and quite simply, what's at stake is that God chose Israel to be salt and light in the midst of a wicked world. Now, I would like to, I wonder if I can get away with this. If I go over, hold on. I'm going to have to get out, aren't I? Is it worth doing? Yeah, it's worth doing. All right, so I'm going to end the slideshow here. I'll go back and forth. I want to go to scriptures. Oh, there's my. Hey, get out of there for a minute. There's my giant step. That's what I wanted you to see so desperately. I see how pedagogically invaluable that was. This is what we're doing right now. I want to take you to the scriptures. There are two scriptures, pivotal scriptures. I give them to you there. And first of all, there is Exodus 12 and verse 3. Look, God, first of all, calls Abraham. Remember I said that he calls Abraham to himself and makes of him a family, an extended family, a clan. Then at Mount Sinai, the family of Abraham becomes the nation of Israel. Well, at those two pivotal turns in the road, God makes a couple of statements which are all important. And first of all, and you're familiar with this, in calling Abraham to himself, he says in Exodus 12, and this is the first expression of the Abrahamic covenant. Oh, come on, I have so much trouble moving this. Here it is. Now listen, forgive me, I didn't set this up very well. That doesn't make any difference to you. But I would like us to be able to see it together. You can open as well, but I can just make this a lot bigger. So, you can almost see that, can't you? Your eyes are better than mine. So the Lord called Genesis 12:3. Yeah, no matter what I was in there, yeah, I was really confused, I'll tell you the truth. Genesis 12. So he calls Abraham, and he says, I'll make you a great nation, bless you, make your name great, you'll be a blessing, bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So he is very explicit that what he is doing in making this one, listen, folks, there's only one people with whom God has ever made this sort of covenant. It's the people of Israel. And people resent that. And they think, well, that's, isn't that playing favorites? Let me just tell you something. This is not a happy assignment. You know what I'm saying? To be the representative of Yahweh God on this earth in the midst of a people who despise Yahweh? Remember Tevye? Maybe you could have chosen somebody else. Remember that as they're getting driven out of there? I'm telling you, that's a reasonable spirit, for heaven's sakes. So he says, so people say, wow, how come they chose him? He chose them in order to be a blessing. Because again, I'm going to say it. Just go back to it real quickly. Genesis 1-11, nothing but rebellion for 1900 years. Now God's going to say, all right, I need to find a way that I can put myself on display before a people who don't want to see me, who are running from me. And I got to find a way to put myself in front of them, whether they like it or not. And it's got to be objective. It's got to be historical. It's not conceptual. That's how God reveals himself. Don't get me started. All right, so in Exodus 12, but then the big one, and these two phrases ought to be emblazoned in your mind. In Exodus 19, and this is Mount Sinai, and there at Mount Sinai, God has, you know the story, Israel at the foot of the mountain, Moses up there in the, before Moses goes up, but God begins to speak, and the glory cloud has descended on Mount Sinai, but he makes a promise. I want you to see it in verse 5. He says, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant. Now this is what he said. You shall be a, and I have it in yellow, a special treasure to me above all people. What does he mean? I'm going to have a relationship with you I don't have with any other people. But then he goes on to say, but notice what he says, for all the earth is mine. So this is not, here's my point. You go through Genesis 1 to 11, and as I say, we call it universal dealings because God is dealing with the race as a race. And now, rather suddenly, in Genesis 12, God, this is a big turn in the road where he calls Abram to himself, and this is a new strategy in terms of human history. And people, again, get this idea, well, maybe he was abandoning. Maybe it was, you know, I've worked with him for 1,900 years, and nothing but rebels. Nuts to them, I'll see if I can get this one family to follow me. Absolutely not. All the earth is mine. But here's what he says, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, Dr. McCune, I always think of him just because of our Grace Seminary roots, but Dr. McCune used to say that in terms of understanding what God's doing in the Old Testament, that may be the most important verse in the Old Testament. You really want to understand what's going on. He says, I am going to make of Israel, now hear that, a kingdom with a priestly capacity. It does not and it cannot mean it's going to be a kingdom which everybody gets to be a priest because we know better. There was a tribe, Levi, and there was a family, Aaron, and they were the only priests. But he says you'll be a kingdom. What do you mean by that? You'll be a kingdom with a priestly function. A priestly kingdom. What does a priest do? He mediates. And so God is going to put himself on display to the world through Israel. And by the same token, and this is the book of Acts again in reverse, the way, this is what I said earlier about in the Old Testament, Gentiles get saved, but they had to identify. She who said, your God will be my God, also said what? Your people will be my people. You hear what she's saying? Folks, you got to understand this. In the ancient world, not all that ancient, but in the pre-modern world, if you don't mind, every nation, well, the Old Testament world, let's say it that way, every nation had its own set of tribal deities of their own gods. They lived on a hill outside the mountain, on a mountain outside of town, and so on. And now they were all these people were polytheists, so you could have a lot of other gods. But these are our gods, and if you are going to be loyal, if you're going to belong to this country, see, the king reigns in the favor of those gods, supposedly. And so if you're going to be accepted as a citizen in this kingdom, you're going to worship those gods. Now, you can worship other gods too. Help yourself. But if you're going to be a Canaanite, you're going to worship Baal. If you're going to be a Babylonian, you're going to worship Baal. This is Daniel chapter 3. Go home and worship whatever gods you want. But when you hear the sound of the orchestra, you bow down to my gods. Does that make sense to you? All right, now here's this Gentile who is perhaps a Canaanite, and he's really impacted by the testimony of Yahweh. In so many ways, we're going to talk about him. And he determines that he is going to embrace Yahweh. He's going to bow the knee to Yahweh. He's going to, this is what faith is in the Bible. Faith is allegiance. I'm going to give my allegiance to Yahweh. I'm going to serve him. I'm going to trust him. That's what it is to give. If you give your allegiance to a king, you trust him to protect you, and you do what he tells you to do. That's what faith is. It's allegiance. So I'm going to give my allegiance to Yahweh. Well, wait a minute. I'm a Canaanite. And what does God demand? What does Yahweh demand? He demands I acknowledge that he's the only one God. And these gods are lies. So you can't turn to God without turning from idols. And when you turn from idols, you're not going to be welcome. See the point? And so in a very real functional way, you abandon. And so, again, this is my point is that they are a priestly kingdom, first of all, in that God, Yahweh, is going to put himself on display to the nations through Israel. And secondly, the nations are going to approach Yahweh through Israel. Folks, you got to understand, and this is so foreign to us. It's so clear in the scriptures, but we got to kind of almost grab our, got to recalibrate our heads rather significantly to think in these terms. In the Old Testament, you had no approach to God other than through that temple. That was your only approach to God. Now, you didn't have to be at the temple, but all around the world. At, mid-morning, at the time of prayer, they'd stop what they were doing, they'd look toward Jerusalem, and they didn't take time zones into account, okay, just that time of day. And because you knew there was an offering being made there at Jerusalem, and that's how you approach God. Remember Luke chapter 1, Zechariah was in, and everybody was outside because it was the time of prayer. That's how you, because there was a sacrifice being made. So my point is, your only approach to God, and the only place where every year in the fall there's a sacrifice made to cover your sin, that's at the temple. There's only one temple. And this is what Jesus meant when he said to the woman, salvation is of the Jews. And people say, well, that just means Jesus is going to come through the Jews. No, that's amen and amen. But the discussion before the house is, she's saying, well, we worship God over here, and you worship God. And Jesus says, salvation is of the Jews. Now, the day is going to come when they're going to worship, but salvation, that's how you get to God. That's what's so distinctive about this age, is that Gentiles can get saved without Acts 15 being circumcised. Remember? All right, I'll leave that alone. So he says, number one, Yahweh says, so in Genesis, when he calls Abram, he says, I'm going to make you a blessing to the entire world. And now he says, I'm going to make you a special treasure because you are going to be a kingdom with a priestly function. You're going to put me on display to the world. Then he goes on, and the world's going to approach me through you. But then he says, and a holy nation. You have to be set apart. I'm going to make you distinct. All right, now I just want to leave that with you and go back to my little, what you call it here, PowerPoint. So my point is simply this, that in choosing Israel, this is, all right, the intent and importance of Israel's influence, what I'm after, and what I'm going to make sure you understand, I want to disabuse your mind forever of the notion, however slight it might be, that somehow God was being dismissive of the rest of the world, that he was abandoning the rest of the world, or that Israel got some really special deal that the rest of the world didn't get. God chose that people in order to put himself on display to the world. Does that make sense to you? See, this is one of the points at which, to me, and this is one of many, many points at which the whole idea of covenant theology, replacement theology is just so, I can't make it even begin to work in my head. Because to say that Israel was the church in the Old Testament and the church is Israel today, Israel, they were a kingdom of priests. One of the dynamics that is true in the Old Testament, that is absolutely manifest, I'm unmistakably true, but it's hard for us, and we tend to overlook it, is simply this. That God was going to put himself on display through Israel as a nation. Now, frankly, it didn't make a whole lot of difference. Now, I'm not saying it didn't make a difference to the heart of God. I'm sure it does. But it didn't make a whole lot of difference to the purpose of God in this regard, how many individual Israelites were genuinely twice-born followers of Yahweh. Because most of them were not at any given time. But the point is that he is going to bless that nation as a nation, and if they are faithful, and I'm telling you, it's so amazing, just the hint of faithfulness. If they just, the slightest hint of dependence on God, and God just blesses them so powerfully. But on the other hand, he's very patient in judgment. But it's by reason of his blessing the nation as a people in the midst of a community of nations, and cursing him as that he's going to put himself on. Does that make sense to you? So they're a kingdom. We're not a kingdom, folks. The church is not a nation. How wouldn't that? We have no ethnic identity. You know, that's crazy to talk about the church as a kingdom. I know the word kingdom is like that fellow who went from Jerusalem to Jericho, you know, fell among thieves and was stripped of all its goods. And kingdom today just kind of means generically doing something for God. You don't have a kingdom until you got a king sitting on a throne in a capital city in a governance where there's a, you know, all right, leave it alone. All right, so here's my point. I'll throw it up there for you, and I already said it, that in choosing Israel, God is not neglecting or rejecting the rest of the peoples of the world. So the intent and importance of Israel's influence, that God would raise up this people who by reason of his covenant relationship and by reason of his, you know, I think it's, you know, I mentioned the Deuteronomy 11:26, I'll bless your obedience and curse your disobedience. And we'd say, well, that's pretty much the way God runs the moral universe, right? I mean, pretty much. Always. Yeah, but, you know, we got to avoid prosperity theology, for heaven's sakes. And the fact is, usually the lines are real. You know, you can't. There's a lot. It gets pretty complicated. And not with Israel. I mean, that quick. They disobeyed. They paid for it. They approached God. David, Kevin, I'm trying to remember which king, maybe I'll find it, but in going through the kings, and then I get them all confused in my head again, but one of them was so godless, and he went out to battle against the king of the north, and he said, am I talking Jeroboam? But he said, he acknowledged that he in the south, no, Rehoboam would be. This won't work. But anyway, he's a horribly godless king, and at some reason, a horrible exigency where he's getting attacked by his enemy from the north, he says, we're the people of God. We depend on God. And God gives him a great victory. He's one of the most wicked kings in the Old Testament, but when he was faithful, God gave him a great victory. And so, at any rate, all right, so number one, the intent and importance of Israel's influence. Secondly, is the principle of providential placement. Now, we're going to do a little Bible geography here. This is familiar to many of you, but try and, I just say the word geography and your eyes glaze over. I can see it from here, but this is hugely important. And you know, let me just tell you something. I will suggest that if you want to ask the question, let's ask the question, if God is going to make of Israel a kingdom of priests, what's the primary element in that effort? What's the primary strategy? It is geography. Geography is unspeakably important. Folks, the way the continents are arranged on the earth is not an accident. And this is stunning, and it's explicit in the scriptures. But let me just take you through it. And I like to explain it this way, that God placed Israel at the most strategic spot on the most important international highway in the ancient world. Now, that highway is called the Fertile Crescent. And you know that, and I like to say it this way, that the two most important cradles of ancient civilization, as far back as we can go, and the world, when they think about this, is going to have some hairy guy dragging a woman by the hair out of a cave. Okay, we're not going there. We're talking about four families getting off an ark, finding a world very, very different than the world they knew, and being given the divine stewardship to overspread the earth with God-honoring culture. Now, they're not very faithful to that, but when culture begins to blossom, it happens in two spots, and that is Egypt to the south and Mesopotamia to the east. Now, the reason for that is because in both cases you have a river. And the Nile River, and the Nile River is the most important river on the face of the earth in terms of ancient history, especially. Egypt was always the breadbasket of the world. And can I just tell you something? When you are reading the Bible, Old, New Testament, I don't care, always read it this way. You're reading about a people who can never presume next year's harvest. They live from harvest to harvest. Starvation is always a real possibility. And what you need is grain. Without grain, you don't have bread for your table, you don't have feed for your livestock, you don't have milk for your children. And so, and the Nile River, by the fact that it overflowed its banks every year, and then when the flood receded, it left this fresh layer of beautifully fertile soil and so on. So the Nile River, it provided grain, but it also, the other dynamic with the river is communication. If it's a navigable river, then you can travel between easily, between and culture and, you know, commerce can develop and so on. So you've got Egypt with the Nile River, and then Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia means between the rivers, and the rivers are, of course, Tigris and Euphrates. And so that's where civilization settled. Now, that began to develop. And a point to be made is this, that here's a map that gives you a little better display. I want to do something different here because I think I can draw on this now. Yeah, I guess I can. Hold on here for just a second. Do I want to do this? Hold on here. Okay, let's try that again now. One more thing here. All right, now can you see that at all? It's pretty faint. But here you have Egypt down here. No, now it's not going to let me draw. Why won't it let me draw? Let me draw a minute. There it is. Oh, it's going to be white again. All right, I'll stay with it. You have Egypt here, Mesopotamia here, and the only way to get from one to the other is to follow this road called the Fertile Crescent. And the Fertile Crescent is defined as a sickle of land, which is can be settled, farmed, and traveled. And here's the important point, and which is surrounded on all sides by territory where that's not possible. So you've got the Arabian Desert thrusting into the underbelly. Does that make sense to you? Totally impassable. This is a no kidding around. You're not coming across here. Okay, if it's you and your buddy, maybe so. But if you're going to move, here it is, an army or a big one, a caravan. If you're going to move an army or a caravan, you're not going to cross the desert. And up here, you got the mountains. So the only way to pass, to make its way. Now, as civilization develops up in Europe and Asia and so on, you get the same thing, the overland route. Now, the point to be made is that, and look, folks, I can get more excited about this than rational human beings would, but the single most important solitary data point of geography that you can learn about Israel is simply this, that Israel is the only truly narrow spot on the Fertile Crescent. The only truly narrow choke point where all the traffic is going to be funneled into one place, and it's only in Israel. And specifically, that's what I say here, that the narrowest spot in the Fertile Crescent. Now, there are other places that are important. Haran was important and so on. But if Haran was, here's the point. If you can control Israel and you can control that choke point on the international highway, all that traffic you can monitor, and here's the big one, you can tax it. So you're going to get fabulously with everybody who wants to control the Eastern Mediterranean world, and it's so interesting to see how God contrived to make this true in various ages and so on. But in the Old Testament, everybody, and the New Testament, what am I saying? If you're going to control the Eastern Mediterranean world, you've got to control Israel. This is the choke point. All right, I can tell you, That's why I say this reality makes the land of Israel remarkably strategic. Do I have all this in your notes? I guess I don't. So I got to. In spite of the fact Israel is tiny, she has absolutely hardly any, no natural defenses. She, you know what? The besetting sin of Israel throughout the Old Testament is Egypt. Because Egypt is everything Israel wishes she were. She's got water. She never has to want for grain. If they ever have famine in Egypt, it's because the water doesn't recede, if the floods don't recede. But they're going to have plenty of soil, and it's going to be well-watered soil. They have beautiful natural defenses, the Mediterranean Sea, the Arabian Desert, the Sinai Desert. Egypt is so impregnable. Israel is right in it. They have none of that. And very little natural resources, no natural harbor. I'll come back to that another time. So the point is that although Israel, and I tell you what, Israel is not a pleasant place to live. It's a tough place to live. Galilee is nice, but the rest of Israel is desert or rocky hills that are almost entirely impassable and unarable. But nonetheless, it's always, everybody is jealous for it. And specifically, I'll just spend a moment with this, and those of you who've been, we spent a whole day at the Jezreel Valley. It's so important. We see it from the west. We see it from the south. We see it from the north when we're there, because it's so important to understand the dynamics of the Jezreel Valley. But the Jezreel Valley is it's kind of an arrowhead-shaped valley. Will this work at all? Kind of right here. And it has a shaft. And all of the traffic, the international traffic in the ancient world, is going to be funneled into the Jezreel Valley. There is one way to avoid it, and that's the King's Highway over here, but you really don't want to go there. It's much more difficult. And the commercial traffic especially wants to. Now, here is approximately the international highways coming from the north. Here is the little Sea of Galilee. Can you see any of this? Here's the little Sea of Galilee, and you're going to either go north and west of the Sea of Galilee or east and then south. Either one will work. But either way, you're going to be funneled into this Jezreel Valley. Now, the Jezreel Valley is a valley because it's bordered on the north and south by hills, and the hill to the south is called Mount Carmel, Elijah's mountain, and it's right here. And in Mount Carmel, whenever in the Bible you talk about mountains, they're just hills, for heaven's sakes. I mean, Mount Carmel is like, 3,200 feet, I think. So, I mean, but if you got a caravan, you're not going to go over that thing. You got to find a pass, and there are three passes. So let's come down from the north. You're coming down with your caravan from the north. You make your way around the Sea of Galilee. You make your way past the Horns of Hattim and into the Jezreel Valley. Now you're in the Jezreel Valley. Here is Mount Carmel, and there are three passes. And you can pick which one you take, but the Yokneam Pass to the north, and the Megiddo Pass, the Central Pass, or the Dothan Pass to the south. Now, do you see where I'm taking? If you can control those three passes, you can monitor and tax. I won't try and put 94.3% of statistics are made up on the spot. Did I tell you that before? So I won't make one up. I don't know. But I'll tell you, I'll bet it's more than half of the international traffic in the ancient world is going to pass through that valley. It has to. Now, the reason I'm going to come to this in a minute is because right here is the Jordan Rift, just to the east. And the Jordan Rift is the deepest declivity on the face of the earth. And way up here, it's 600 feet below sea level. And so if you go in there, you got to climb back out. And the further south you go, the more impossible it comes. And there's no water down there to speak. Well, there is water, but not enough. But the big thing is it's no defensibility. But the point is, so you don't want to go here. And you desperately want to go out here to what's called the Via Maris, the way of the sea. That's where the living's good. That's where the travel's easy along the coastal plain. The only way to get there is to go into the Valley of Jezreel and to pick one of those three passes. Now, what's that got to do with anything? Where am I taking it? Because I'm saying, so this is the great bottleneck in the international highway. That's why they always wanted to conquer it. Now, here's my point. Folks, in the ancient world, people wanted to know what was going on in the world. They were very interested. Obviously, news traveled not nearly so fast, but probably a lot more dependably, to be honest with you. But nonetheless, it wasn't quite so fast. But the fact is that the primary way And I'm talking about all sorts of news, whether there was a battle, whether it was the coup, whether it was a new king, whether it was a royal wedding, whether there was a new invention that you heard about, you're anxious to see it. And what would happen is there were people, and they were usually called heralds, but they would go, and if they knew a battle was shaping up, they'd sit in a hill somewhere and draw pictures and so on. And then they would attach themselves, in every case, to a caravan. It was like going west in the early days of this country because it was dangerous. And so you just attach yourself to a wagon train. Maybe you're not part of the wagon train. You just pay the wagon master a little bit. And that's how you get. That's how you, and everywhere you went. And people would live well by being these traveling historians. And they would attach themselves to a caravan. And everywhere they went, they would be sought out. The wealthiest families would invite them and give them the finest quarters and fate them and so on. They wanted to hear what was going on in the world. See where I'm taking you? All those caravans were going through Israel. And you know what? There was a God in Israel who was in. Did they have stories to tell? And those stories got carried to the ends of the earth, and we know dead certain they got carried to the ends of the earth. How'd that happen? Geography. God shaped the earth in such a way that traffic was going to make its way through. And he said that in Ezekiel. He said, I put you in the center of the nations. And I'm going to tell you something. So much more effectively than we realize. We have this idea that God kind of decided, well, I'm going to work with Israel. And they got this little tiny plot of ground. So I'll just pretty much reveal myself there and the world will have to figure its own way out. Oh, no, 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 no. God doesn't work that way. And he put himself on display powerfully, narratively, through the stories of what he was doing on behalf of Israel. And they were carried to the furthest points of the earth. That make sense to you? So, I like to say that God did not send Israel to the world. I know there's confusion about that. I have a son named Jonah. Jonah's kind of a hero of mine. But the biblical Jonah is what I had in mind there. But he was not a missionary. Or let's say it this way, to find some sort of a missionary imperative in the Old Testament on the basis of Jonah is just not there. Israel was told to stay home. They were told to marry Yahweh worshipers because God would deal with that nation as a nation in such a way the rest of the world would hear about it. Now just ponder for just a couple of seconds how totally distinct that is from what God's doing today. He's gathering us together as believers. We work very hard in this church to make sure the people who are invited and become part of this church are genuine believers, because as a body, we're going to evangelize. We're going to take the gospel to this territory, and then we're going to send people out to do it. That's what Jesus commanded us to do in this age, not in the Old Testament. He was working through Israel as a people, and as if they stayed home, and God blessed their obedience, cursed Israel. All right, as number two. What time? 9 o'clock? Okay, what do we think? Or 8:30? 8:30. All right. I'm on borrowed time. Let me give you one more because it fits so much, and I can finish this tomorrow. No, I better not. So let's leave it at that. Honest to goodness, because this next one's too much fun. It'll take me 10 minutes. And so let's just rehearse real quickly because we're going to just pick this up tomorrow. Cosmically, what we're thinking about is how God has contrived to put himself on display to the world to glorify himself. What is the primary doxological strategy of God? I am contending that is, biblically in terms of the narrative, it is God's dealings with a terribly rebellious people called Israel. And it is instructive to, number one, to ponder the narrative of the Scripture within that construct. Rather than trying to force everything into some sort of a reference to the cross or something, bless God for all the references to the cross you find, if they're really there. But don't be sucking them out of your thumb because your theology demands it. That's my point. But on the other hand, I this is a thought experiment. You have to, you know, stagger along with me. I just thought it would be instructive to compare the dynamics of what God is doing in the Old Testament. And then next couple of nights after this, we'll look at the way the distinctive way God is working today, some very deliberate, explicit distinctions about what God is doing today, and then try and understand how that all fits together as part of a continuing strategy to glorify himself. All right? I'm pretending I just made some sense of this. Shall we have a word of prayer? All right, thank you. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we do rejoice in your goodness to us. We would pause to very deliberately worship you as our God. Apart from that which you have done on our behalf, apart from the revelation you have, we would not know you apart from that revelation, but we honor you as our God, and you are infinitely worthy of our worship. But then, Father, we would go further and honor you for that which you have wrought on our behalf, certainly in the gift of your Son, certainly in the confidence that we belong to you through his death, certainly in the hope that we have for life to come. But even beyond that, Father, thank you that you have revealed to us so carefully your handiwork and your design and your strategy, and all that to the end that we would stagger and wonder at your wisdom and your grace. So, Father, I'd pray you'd help us to that end. Thank you so much for this good work and for how you have prospered it over the years, and pray that you continue to do that in days to come. Thank you in Christ's name. Amen.